Radio.
Hello.
Hello.
Goodbye. And I say hello. That's it. You always have to wonder what's going on with these silly theme songs here.
Silly is the right word.
I'm in a silly mood. I just got back from an eye doctor appointment, and my eyes are all dilated, so everything's all blurry.
Well, is your heart open?
Yeah. Well, no, not that's a wrong question to ask. I have had an open heart, you know.
This is the Rebooting the News number 71.
71. Why would heart being open have anything to do with 71?
Eyes dilated, heart open.
I never heard of that. Is that an Elvis Costello song?
I'm Jay Rosen, and the other voice you hear is my podcast partner, Dave Weiner.
Hi, Jay.
Hi. And we're back from our sojourn to Washington.
What a trip.
Where we performed this show live in front of
The
Online News Association. So how do you think it went, David?
Well, I learned one thing. It's always a good idea to not go live from immediately. It's a good idea to have a few moments to plug the mics in and to test out the connection.
Make sure you're recording.
My God, it was like, a crazy situation. I mean, it's this like impedance mismatch because, conferences are sort of like, they're right there physically all the time. And this idea of having something that's broadcast out of a conference is... It's a real... You ought to have the room for two sessions, really, to really be able to do
that,
right?
It's a collision of two different worlds.
Yeah. But I thought it was a very good discussion, and, it was good. And, we hit a lot of the high points, and there were people that were very much part of an audience who brought with them all of their ideas from the, from the press world. And,
right.
The View from Nowhere and all the rest of it, which we will talk about. This was a big week, I hear, for the View
from
Nowhere.
Big week for the View from Nowhere,
right.
Yeah.
So
that's Rebooting the News number 70, for those who would like to listen to it.
Yeah.
This is Rebooting the News number 71, and we have a full agenda, don't we?
I think so.
Yeah.
I think we'll run out of time before we run out of things to talk about.
Let's start with MacBook Air. You got a new computer.
I did. It was a total...
You're a sucker for these things, aren't you?
I have to buy every one. It's like...
You're easy to market to.
When it comes to Apple stuff, it's Apple and Amazon have a tag team thing going.
And they just push your button.
Well, I push theirs.
You push their button.
Yeah, it's like after Apple announces a product, Steve Jobs gets up there and he says it's magical and it's different.
The best ever.
It's wonderful. And we really... I think this is special. And look at all the places this is going, blah, blah, blah. And I go, I find that very disgusting. I mean, I kind of want to slap.
And you see through the hype, but there you go, trooping
to
the Apple Store.
I know, but I'm thinking in the back of my mind, maybe it is wonderful.
Right.
Maybe
this time.
And I don't want to miss it. So then what I do is I go to see if Amazon has the product yet, right? And so invariably they do. And they have a page there. And up at the top of the page, there are these two buttons, okay? One button says, they both say one click, okay? One says, for $3.99, I can have it there tomorrow.
Right.
And the other one says, 2 days.
Oh, so now your instant gratification is pushing.
Well, and the mental process goes like this. Is like, well, I know that at some point I'm probably going to press the button.
Right.
So if I press it now,
start enjoying it now.
Right, I can start enjoying this right away.
Right.
And the timing is absolutely perfect because... they don't get me in the store. I actually went to the Apple Store before this to actually look at one of these.
Yeah.
And they don't get me because the guilt connect is right there. But here the guilt doesn't... I don't have to feel the guilt until the thing actually arrives.
Right.
And by the time it arrives, I've already sort of accepted that I've bought this thing.
So is it in fact... important in the evolution of computers at all? I mean,
well, I think
is there anything?
It's a nice computer.
Beyond that, is it?
It's both a very annoying computer, angry-making computer, and it's also a very nice computer. It's angry, annoying-making because it really is a comparable computer to the Asus EEE PC, which I'm a big fan of. You know, it has, it's about the same weight. It fits into a knapsack the same way. It's a very lightweight computer. You know, you can throw it in a knapsack and you don't know you have it. That's sort of a big test. It's very nice that way. But it has less features. The battery life is nowhere near as long as the Asus. Nowhere near. Not even remotely in the same ballpark. One would have thought that with all the experience with the iPad, and they kind of led you to believe this in the announcement, that, you know, we learned a lot from the iPad, and, you know, because we've really tuned this thing up for power consumption, you know, you'll get the same kind of battery life. They didn't quite say that, but, you know, it's nowhere near it. Whereas the Asus is much better. The Asus has three USB ports. This has two. The Asus has an Ethernet port. This only, this does not have an Ethernet port. It has, the Asus has an SD card slot, which is very useful. This does not have an SD card slot. And here's the big one. The Asus costs $349. This thing costs $1,300. So it's like you're getting less and you're paying more. Wow. And you're paying a lot more. And, you know, that's just Apple. And, you know, they, all this condescension they do for the Asus is ridiculous. The Asus is a very nice package. It's made of plastic. It's not made of titanium. It's not unibody. It's different. But it has a very nice, you know, sort of mass production feel to
it. But it's not a Mac.
No, but it's still a good computer. Yeah. I mean, no, it's not a Mac. You know, it suffers from Microsoft's unwillingness to be a success. I
mean, yeah.
If Microsoft really wanted to kick butt, they could have. They've just sort of crippled these machines and said they can't add any more features to it because they don't really want people to buy it. And that's really stupid. I mean, you have whatever. But
all right, let's move on.
Yeah.
You were at a rather interesting meeting this week in Washington, since you continue your itinerant life up and down the Northeast Corridor.
Yeah, I go to Washington three
times
a week.
You patrolled the territory from Boston to Washington.
That's good. You're in a mood today, Jay.
What was this meeting at the Library of Congress about, and why did you decide to go?
Well, I decided to go because it's like my thing. I'm very interested in future safe archives, because right now we're very much not safe against the future. Big pieces of our legacy fall off the face of the earth every year.
So the Library of Congress wanted to discuss what?
I don't really know exactly what they wanted to. This is why I was.
What did they say they wanted to?
Well, they wanted to talk about archiving as it relates to the social web, to the blogosphere. And they're very enthusiastic, and they're very intelligent, and they're librarians. And God knows we love librarians.
Yeah.
You know, they're our kindred
spirit. Librarians are the good guys.
Yeah, they're the good guys. But that said, they're not really doing a whole lot of archiving. They're not doing any, as far as I can tell, of the. History of the blogosphere, and I'm left with the impression that we need to get this ball rolling ourselves, and then hope that once we have the process working out, that they'll be ready to work with us, you know, on that basis. Because right now we're not going to get it from them.
So who is there besides you?
A lot of academics, a lot of librarians. Almost no software developers. I was one, and there was a guy from who was a consultant who worked for WordPress. There were a few reporters. Dan Gilmore was there. There were a few people from. There was a guy from. I'm so bad with memory. There was a local website from a small town in Vermont. It's a great site, and I can't remember the name of it. It'll come to me in the middle of the show, probably. He was very interesting, and there was a guy from had Brooklyn blogs, and so they had a few people there to sort of present the use case.
Anyone from the Internet Archive?
Yes, there was somebody there from the Internet Archive. Two people, basically, from Internet Archive, and they were very supportive of what the Library of Congress was doing. You know, it was a good thing to discuss, but. I'm ready to work on this right now. I'd like to start working on this, and I'm not sure anybody else right now is really ready to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
See, I would just assume that depending on the federal government to be able to do anything would just be a hopeless case. and that
yeah, but this is the Library of Congress.
Library of Congress, even the lab, but it's still it's a branch of the federal government,
right?
And that it would, you know, it would basically be impossible for them to move, because of all the restrictions.
Well, they have done a deal with Twitter, that's for sure, and they're very proud of that deal. And I pointed out
a deal with Twitter to accomplish what?
To archive all of our tweets.
Oh, really?
Yeah. All of our tweets are being archived. So, you know, I mean, for whatever that's worth. I mean, I tried to point out that Twitter is a privately held company and that they're using this for competitive advantage, and it creates a barrier to entry for other would-be competitors, et cetera, et cetera. You know, I didn't really do a good job of painting that picture. I mean, it would be, to me, like... you know, doing some kind of energy conservation deal with ExxonMobil, you know, and not doing it with, you know, whoever, you know, Greenpeace.
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
You know, I would prefer if they did it based on open formats and protocols so that then, you know, it would be open, right? What a concept.
That's the kind of thing a librarian should be able to understand.
I really thought they would. Yeah. You know what it is, Jay? Technology is... a reality distortion field. And because there's so much great press for, you know, the leaders of the tech biz, they supposedly see something that the rest of us don't see. They're kind of snowed.
There's also this, Dave. Twitter especially, but at a certain time, blogging was this too. They become these totems for the present, right? In that, if you are doing a deal with Twitter, if you are quote unquote on Twitter,
right.
That itself is supposed to be a kind of a mark of your currency,
right?
And often that sort of symbolic statement is enough,
right?
And nobody actually looks at, well, what are you doing with Twitter?
Yeah,
you know, what are you doing?
Yeah, I think that with your blog goes back to the beginning of time. I think cavemen had those kinds of concepts that, you know, anybody that had a, you know, a bow and arrow.
Yeah, have you heard about this new thing, fire?
Yeah,
oh,
fire.
Yeah, sure, we're into
fire.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah, we got plenty of fire.
Exactly.
We've been on fire for...
Right, I mean, it's human nature, I guess. I don't know, whatever.
Well, that transitions smoothly into the White House blogger.
Yeah, well, you know... You want me to talk about that?
Yeah, well, let's talk about that. You wrote a post this week about the White House blogger.
It didn't come out of nowhere. It came because we had the midterm elections and the Democrats were very disappointed, and you know, and
everyone's giving up on Obama.
Well, yeah, I think what we found is that people gave up on him a while ago,
right?
And then, so the question is, what happened? And, you know, the Washington Insiders will always paint it in terms of the nonsense Washington Insider excuses for things, like he didn't cooperate with the Republicans.
Overreach.
That was right. Yeah,
that's the
he
big
was
one.
Too liberal. Right. Yeah, really? Yeah. Show me how. I'd love to know more about that.
You actually ran your analysis at your blog. See, I would never do that.
Run what?
Your analysis of why Obama lost.
Why wouldn't you not do that?
I just wouldn't.
Okay. Well,
I'm not a political pundit. I stay very narrowly in the tracks that
I mean,
have
everybody
laid
out. Can use their blog however they see fit. My blog is a very personal thing and always has been. And especially the political stuff, I consider that very important to write about the political stuff because... when I've done it, when I started doing it initially, everybody told me, oh, no, you need to stick to technology.
No, and this I would never say that.
No, I know you wouldn't. But
yeah.
Yeah, well, this was like real early days in the blogosphere. And what I wanted to say to these people is that everybody, in my opinion, is obligated to have a political opinion.
Oh, yeah.
That's
what it means to
be an American, you know? And so if what you feel is that I shouldn't be expressing it, then that makes me want to express it all the more because I want you to go through that. I want you to get over this idea that it needs to be an exceptional thing for somebody to express a political thought.
You love being an irritant, don't you?
No, Jay. I love to be loved. You don't know. No, I am a teacher. I'm a teacher. Now, to the extent that teachers irritate their students, maybe, but that is, you know, that would be to miss the point. I very much want things to be a certain way. And
oh, does that all?
Yeah, and okay. And that's how, you know, well, I didn't make the point, though. The point I was getting to, and that it's in the piece, is that we believed in this change you can believe in, change mm-hmm. we can believe in.
Mm-hmm.
As crazy as it was to believe that, we did. And we can't really be faulted for that, because if you look at Obama, he is a change in body. He is a change.
Right.
He's a different race. He's young. He's intelligent. And he asked us to believe in that. He used the internet in ways that it was easy to extrapolate that he would continue to use the internet going
forward. Well,
that's
where I really related to what you said. I'm one of those people who thought that maybe he would take the lessons of organizing people over the internet that he demonstrated his facility with during the campaign and bring those into governing.
Right.
Because the only way of changing the culture of Washington was obviously to bring outside influence and outside pressure on it. You can't do it just by trying to be a clever negotiator or, you know.
And there you had
down.
The perfect mechanism to do it.
Yeah.
It actually works. It actually does. And I was thinking, let's run a 365-day-a-year political campaign. You know, Obama, tell us every week, what is the issue this week that we need to be focused on? What problem are we going to solve collectively together?
Mm.
And this was the problem, you see. You know, how do you reconcile somebody in 2008 voting for Obama and then in 2010 voting for a Tea Party candidate? And the answer is they just simply want to have power and exercise that power.
Or they're pro-disruption.
Well,
in 2008 and 2010.
Well, because they don't like, because they're scared about where things are going.
So they want to disrupt Washington. That's what I'm saying.
But I don't think that, you know, I don't like where that goes, because I really don't think that's what's going on. I think people want to feel effective. I think they want to feel like they can do something to make the things better. And if the only power they have to make things better is their vote, then they're going to use the vote for that.
Right.
If we were all actively involved in helping America, then we would probably take some of the responsibility ourselves for the problems, which ultimately we are the ones who are responsible for what's going on. It would be the adult, mature, realistic thing to do to take that responsibility ourselves.
This is a strategy the political class does not recommend and also knows nothing about.
We need to replace the political class, then.
Right.
I mean, that's I believe, this is something that came up at the Online News Association.
Yes, it did.
Which is that you won't see a reboot in the political system until you see the reboot fully realized in the press system. That they're one and the same. And so when we're talking about, you know, new channels for information and ideas to flow, eventually the converse is also true, is that once the news system reboots, the political system will too.
Mm.
Has to.
Okay, so with all that as the background, what is the job of the White House blogger, or what should be the job of the White House blogger?
Agent provocateur, in my opinion. There you go. That's the one. That's the person who needs to stir the pot.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And basically, it's a pointing job. It's a, you know, people come back to the place that sends them away, right? So I want to know what's happening in the United States that's interesting and that's relevant to the change process in the United States, mm-hmm. the ways we can make the country better, but not boring. It can't be boring.
Right.
It has to be exciting and titillating and
so it's
angering.
A news weave of everything new and interesting that's going on in sort of solving problems, making government better. Right?
But not boring. It has to. When Newt Gingrich and Cantor and whatever, they say that this is Boehner, say that this is in the pocket of the left wing, sissy, limp wristed, you know, liberal, East Coast elite. You have to point to them saying that. You have to throw it right back in their face. It's like, fine, you want to say that? This is a perfect place to say that.
So the White House blogger should be...
independent, too, by the way.
Independent.
Can't, like the FDA.
Writer, chief. But really a very talented linker and scourer of the web, who brings to the attention of the nation genuinely interesting new problem-solving news, as well as highlighting the debate about how to solve problems, right? And making the WhiteHouse.gov, the front page of WhiteHouse.gov, a kind of a switchboard or gathering place for that original change you can believe in idea, taken down from the clouds of abstraction into real developments, right?
Yeah. Super concrete, right
there. Yeah, super concrete. Yeah.
There's a page that you want to refresh every so often.
right.
Yeah.
You know, that's the only job in the government I would be qualified for. I would love to do that job. Not that I'm suggesting myself or that the job even exists, because it doesn't exist, and nobody would ever allow that to happen within the White House as presently constituted.
I think that's obviously true. You know, the White House blogger would not be the only blogger any more than the head of the FDA or the head of the Federal Reserve Bank is the only banker or the only drug regulator. I mean, there would be a lot of blogging activity. That's point number one. So there would be roles, lots and lots of roles. Plus, I doubt that this would end up being the biggest political, exchange out there. It would stimulate 5 or 15 others, The Republican, let's say the Democrats were in power when this happened, the Republicans would immediately have their own. And it would be very popular.
Yeah.
And as would...
The RNC blogger.
Right, absolutely, and that would be
the government in waiting.
That's correct. That's exactly where I was going. Right. Yeah. So the minute that
the White House blogger,
they have to do is change the DNS entry.
Right. So
the blogosphere has to be where politics lives, not on Twitter. Twitter is the dress rehearsal for that too. Twitter's the dress rehearsal for the news system of the future.
It'd be a cool job. It's a juicy job.
It would be a killer job. It'd be a killer job. Of course, I would sign up for that. Well, I would pay to do that job.
I'd be glad to compete against you for it.
I would win.
Yeah. We'll see.
I love you, Jay. It's like, may the best man win.
Yeah, that's right. Hey. Right.
Yeah.
Can you outthink and can you outlink me?
Definitely. Next question.
But it was one of my real disappointments with the Obama White House.
That was
when
I
saw that they were going to use the blog. There is a White House blog, and that they were going to do the most unimaginative thing you could possibly do, which is to treat it as a press release. Printing press.
It was the absolute moment when we realized this was not going to be any different, that all we did was we get a guy who looks different, who sounds different, but is not different.
Yeah, and when you ask people who work in politics about this, they tell you all the practical reasons why it's so hard to, to change these things. But
why? What's the answer? Why is it so hard?
Well, I'm just saying, I don't think they have good reasons. I'm just telling you they give you a list of of reasons.
Yeah. kind
of
like the Library of Congress when it comes to archiving the
web. That's the problem, isn't it? It's like we don't have...
I said, man, I'll help you find all the old blogs from the beginning,
Yeah.
Let's go digging through it. I'm not saying we'll find every one of them, but I'll find a lot of them for you, and then we'll archive them. Let's not argue about it, we need to argue about this. whatever.
It was a big week for the View from Nowhere, Dave.
Tell us about that, Jay.
Well, let me back up a minute. I have different ways of working as a writer online. And one of them is I like to introduce terms and smuggle them into the wider discourse and get them adopted. And it's fun. It's also a challenge. And I do it when I think that there's a missing term, a missing concept that would help people have better debates about things that come up routinely. And in journalism, one of the things that comes up routinely is, of course, the whole notion of objectivity. And what I had observed over the years, more than 25 years of studying this construct and also participating in debate about it, is that conversation often gets stuck around that notion because it goes, you know, maybe one step or two, and then it just peters out. So people say, but nobody can be totally objective. We all know that. And then the professional journalist says, but it's good to try as hard as you can, and it's an unreachable ideal, but it's still important. And then the people say, who criticize objectivity, say, what are you, crazy? You're not objective. And it just leads to a lot of fighting. So I wanted to redescribe this concept in a way that would sharpen it a little bit and also sort of add an idea or two. So I came up with this term, the view from nowhere, to describe what I think professional journalists actually believe in. And what the view from nowhere is it's a strategy that professional journalists have for generating trust. And the way you generate trust through the view from nowhere is by saying, I'm not on this side, and I'm not on that side. I'm not a liberal, I'm not a conservative. I'm not saying that this is the right way, and I'm not saying that this alternative is the right way either. I'm just telling you the way it is, so believe it, because I have no view. Okay, so the view from nowhere, it's not exactly the same thing as objectivity, because there are parts of objectivity I don't have any problem with. For example, the notion that there are facts out there that are really hard and you can't dismiss them, I buy that. The notion that it's our job, both as critics, observers, citizens, and as journalists, to try and see the world the way it is, not the way we wish it was, I don't have any problem with that either, right? So it's not objectivity itself that's the problem. It's this idea that you can generate trust or authority by pushing off from both sides, right? Trying to make room for yourself by isolating this extreme over here and isolating that extreme over there. And what happens, of course, is that this becomes formulaic. It becomes a ritual, not an actual truth claim. So anyway, I've been writing about the view from nowhere since 2003. And on Twitter, I just started using it habitually, as if it were a term in common circulation, even though it's actually something that I used, right? And just by repetition and by deploying this term enough over many different situations so people could see what it meant, using it again and again to describe dozens and hundreds of situations, it starts to make sense to people after a while. And a couple of weeks ago, it crept into the New York Times.
Literally?
Yeah. Without my name attached to it.
How did you feel? Does that feel like you had a child that had left home and...
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I loved it. And this is one of the cool things.
Wait
about
till somebody else takes the term and makes it mean something else.
Well,
that's
one of the risks
crazy.
You take.
I've had that happen,
sure.
Boy. Woo.
But what's interesting that's about fun. It is that if you want to have influence by launching terms
right.
that others use, you can't also have the credit for them because right. what happens is they become part of the
so
language.
So where was it used?
It was used in Brian Stelter's column on Juan Williams being bounced from NPR.
That's a good place.
And it's yeah. and what he said was that this showed a conflict between the sensibility at Fox and the view from nowhere at NPR. Right. And so what's happening in the wider world is that these conflicts between news organizations that uphold or are still kind of wedded to the view from nowhere and the people they employ who are discovering that there's another way out there that actually works better keep happening and keep causing problems. Because one of the main points I try to make with this term, view from nowhere, is that while it might have been a strategy that generated trust at a certain point in media evolution, mm-hmm. now it is just as likely to increase mistrust if I take the view from nowhere. And it's easier to trust, here's where I'm coming from, or transparency, than it is the view from nowhere. Okay, this right. is one of my major points that I have to make over and over again.
And they're really struggling with
it. But they're struggling.
Yeah. I mean, in the case of NPR, they hire Juan
Huge
Williams
struggle.
To have an opinion, to come from somewhere, and yet when he does that, they have a disconnect. They have a problem. And Olbermann, who is so heavily opinionated that it's impossible to see him in any way coming from having, you know, living at the view from whatever, however you say that in English, but he is not a view from nowhere dude, okay?
Right.
And yet somehow there's a problem with him giving money to
Yeah, so here's what happened.
I don't get that. I mean,
the Politico, checking through public records, looking for stories about who contributed to whom, discovers that Keith Olbermann made three contributions to congressional candidates in this cycle for the maximum $2,400 to three different candidates running for Senate and House. And in one case, at least, maybe two, there were people he had had on his show, people who had clearly believed in himself. Right.
Yep.
And Politico ran a story about it. And Olbermann said, yeah, it's true, I contributed this money, but I didn't ask viewers of MSNBC to contribute money, and that was it. I gave money to these candidates because I'm a citizen, and I decided to do that. And a couple of days later, in a move that shocked almost everybody observing it, MSNBC suspended him. And he was off the air on Friday. He'll be off the air tonight. And he will be allowed back on Tuesday night. Now, they said he violated a code of ethics or, let's say, a rules for employees at NBC that prevent them from giving any money to candidates unless they get permission. Now, who knows what chain of events actually conspired to cause the president of MSNBC to suspend his star show host.
Well, the latest story is it was that he refused to apologize.
Right. So let's say he refused to apologize on air. He refused to apologize for a code of conduct that is entirely mismatched to what he does and to who he is.
Yep.
And it shows that there's a problem because you actually have entire organizations built around the view from nowhere. And they are doing things that are actually based in a different system for trust and reliability. But the cost of actually facing the transition from one belief system to another is so high that they kind of delay it. They want to push it away. They want to prevent the day of confrontation between the old system and the new. Meanwhile, they're letting people do things that are actually a new system. And so what happens is that they come into these controversies, right? They insist on antiquated rules, which the left hand is insisting on, and the right hand is saying, these aren't the rules anymore. Even people who are dedicated ideological opponents of Keith Olbermann and MSNBC, like William Crystal, said, this is absurd. Right?
It's but absurd.
But somehow NBC...
This goes back to what you said a few minutes ago. Is like you accept that there are facts. This is... It's an opinion that this is absurd, but it's very close to being a fact.
It's absurd. And I
think we can all more or less agree that
300,000 people signed a petition saying you should restore Keith Olbermann to the air.
Whatever you think of Keith Olbermann, I'm not a big fan of Keith Olbermann, but I am a big fan of getting connected with reality. And MSNBC is very... I heard Rachel Maddow's explanation for this.
Yeah.
And I was kind of appalled by what she said. She said, well, this is the way you know that we're not like Fox.
She did say that.
Yeah, well, give me a break. You are like Fox.
Well, see,
maybe you ought to get rid of this little, you know, this is not enough to make you not like Fox.
I think
they are like
we have
Fox.
To be careful about that.
Why?
Because I don't think that MSNBC operates the way Fox operates.
Well, but the differences are pretty much a hair split. I mean,
they are?
Absolutely. I mean, people give Fox a hard time because they have presidential candidates in waiting on their, you know, contributor. They are contributors to their TV show, right? Well, Olbermann puts candidates on air that he gives money to. Is there a big difference?
I think there's a huge difference.
Well, it's a quantitative
difference.
Between
being a farm team for the Republican Party and having...
It's on the same path. It's a quantitative difference, not a qualitative difference.
See, I don't agree with you.
Okay, well...
But I do think that they both...
I find neither of them tasteful.
They both depart from
the View
from
Nowhere. Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
In the spirit of not being the View from Nowhere, do you watch either of those...
Network. I watch MSNBC occasionally.
I used to.
I watch Fox during big events. I will tune them in. Like
you know what MSNBC was good for me was as a way of channeling my rage against Bush.
Yeah.
And
that's the origin of the network.
Right. And that was very useful for me because I felt completely powerless to do anything about it. And I needed, the only way I could deal with the rage that I felt was to actually know that there were other people who had ways of expressing it too.
Yeah.
But they became obsolete for me as soon as Bush was out of office, and I never watched them again.
No, see, I don't agree with that.
Well, how could you agree or disagree? I'm talking about me.
Yeah, I don't have the same view as what
okay,
I meant.
Fair enough.
If you look at what Rachel Maddow does on the air, I think she's doing something that's very interesting journalistically, and she does things that nobody else will do. For example, she will do a long intro to an issue and bring on a guest who is involved in that issue.
Right.
And the first question she'll ask him is, did I get anything wrong in my lead-in there? Anything you want to correct? I've never seen a television journalist
do that. No,
she's
very good.
Well,
I'll give
that's
her
interesting.
That.
I mean, another thing she does is she, unlike Olbermann, who's a very different breed from Maddow, in my opinion, she makes repeated invitations, please, to conservatives and Republicans to come on her program and will say to them that I will be fair and forthright with you. And I think the reason they don't is not that they won't get a fair hearing. It's that she's too good. She will probably outthink them on the air, and that's why they don't do it. Now, Olbermann does not do that. He is much more of a...
She should be on a different network. I mean, you can't say that she'd be on a different network. And then
maybe.
If she were, then she would have a point. But she's on MSNBC, and they are very much not a news organization.
Really?
Yeah, really.
She says Fox is a political organization and we're a news organization. You don't buy that?
No, absolutely
really?
Not. No, they're a political organization.
All right.
I mean, maybe I ought to watch some more Rachel Maddow, you know, I did watch her, though, during the campaign, and boy, no, she is a absolute advocate for a point of view. There's no question about it. If she says she's not, then she's
no, she doesn't say that. No,
she is an advocate. She knows
yes,
it, right.
But okay. That's different than being a political organization.
I don't think there's anything wrong with what they do. I think it is wrong when they take the position that she took in her explanation. And the explanation was off the wall.
All right. Well,
but maybe we've discussed this one enough.
Well,
I think
let's exit
more
with
or less beaten this horse to
let
death.
Let me add one more idea, Dave. To me, and I've tried to think carefully about these things, the essence of a political perspective is that you are power-seeking. The essence of a news organization is that it is truth-seeking.
What if you are neither?
Well, you can be neither.
It's very hard to say that Olbermann is truth-seeking.
Being neither is actually what a commercial strategy requires, right? Yeah. Because if you're...
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah.
No, well, you don't need to explain. I understand.
Okay, so...
So what is Olbermann?
I think Olbermann is...
Is a power-seeking...
Is, I think Olbermann is really a confounding mix, and his first commitment is not journalistic. But Maddow, I think, is...
Hmm.
And
well, that's why I said she should go to a different network then.
Maybe.
Yeah. I mean, okay. That would be the best solution because they all mix together, and it's sort of like it's the weakest link in the chain that really defines who you are in that way. I mean, so she could stand a little bit higher. She could start another network, which would be very valuable. And I'm not saying that there's no value to what MSNBC does.
Yeah.
However, I think, like a lot of other people, that was a really ridiculous thing that they did with Olbermann.
It was.
It only made them look stupid.
Yeah.
And it made them look stupid the same way NPR looked stupid when they tried to pretend that Juan Williams was anything other than what Juan Williams is.
Yeah. And the way that people hang on to these...
We've only got 4 minutes, you know.
...concepts is really interesting. Yeah, we only have four
So we want to talk about... we have trouble with the name of this product... Rock Melt. And I just say Tuna Melt. Or
why do we need a new browser?
We don't.
What's interesting about this one? Rock
Not
Melt.
Very much. What's interesting...
What makes it a good subject,
well, what's we ought to talk about it. I mean, we ought to talk about it, if nothing else, that today was its birthday.
Yeah.
And it was a rather impressive rollout. And
Mark Andreessen is behind it.
And a
it.
Very, very interesting strategy for virality.
Yeah.
The way they did it was basically they enabled a certain number of people. They gave them the keys for the download, and then each one was allowed to invite 5 other people, but only people who were friends of theirs on Facebook who had asked for it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So they used.
Were you one?
What?
Did you get one?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Atul Arora, who's the...
Yeah, link. I know Atul.
He's
yeah.
the god of links in right. the tech world. He validated me.
Uh-huh.
And in turn, I validated a bunch of NYU people. I validated Cody Brown.
Oh, cool.
And Lily Q and a few other people. And then I also played favorites with some tech people who I wanted to... you know, say, hey, I remember you're there, and, you know, I like you, et cetera, et cetera. It's a nice, very nice thing to do. That said, the product is very uninspiring, a result of groupthink.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not to say that there isn't a product
90
there
seconds.
That would be a sort of a very, you know, expensive, high-level interface for Facebook, absolutely possible, and something that was implemented. I mean, Andreessen, Mark Andreessen's the backer of this.
Right.
And Andreessen, you know, his pedigree is amazing. I mean, yeah. He's the founder of Netscape.
Fascinating
and
guy.
And hugely rich guy, and also on the board of Facebook. So in right. a position to benefit from a lot of inside knowledge that then could be embodied in the product.
Right.
Now, that said, the product's completely uninspiring. As people have pointed out, you could do the same thing with a plug-in. You know, so, you know, go back to the drawing board and try again. You know, they certainly have the ability to do that.
Wouldn't it be interesting to find a browser designed and created by one person? You know, like
that's
Sam's
the point.
Browser.
Exactly. Yeah, no, that's what I said, is that to pull something like this off, they have a beautiful picture of the team there, and it's this, you know, there's 30 people there in the
right.
picture, and you go, well, that's the problem. They, you know, they had off-sites, and they put up, you know, stick-ups, you know, whatever, you know.
Why don't you make a browser?
Because I got enough other things to do, Jay. I mean, it's like, you know, I got... I don't see that happening tomorrow, but thank you for the vote of confidence. I think we need to... Adrian is telling us... Hey, 10 seconds! Okay, you say goodbye.
Goodbye.
And I say...
Hello.
Hello.
And let's split the difference.
Okay, good night.
Good night.